Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Landscapes, an exhibition of paintings by David Stratton, also featuring a bluegrass jam every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom located at 17 East Taylor in downtown Champaign, on the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Making the transition from elementary school to middle school is a milestone for children. Minds and bodies are undergoing big changes. Journalist Linda Perlstein puts it like this: more than anything, middle school pulls in children and pitches back teenagers. On the program today, we'll get a glimpse of the lives of middle schoolers. Linda Perlstein is our guest. As education reporter for The Washington Post, she spent a year inside a suburban Maryland middle school. She wrote a series of articles on what she learned for The Post, and that became the basis for the book, Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the local dialing area, feel free to use the toll-free line. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Linda Perlstein was a prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post. She left the paper last year to work on her second book, an examination of the fallout of the standards and testing movement in schools. She grew up in Milwaukee. She now makes her home in Baltimore. Her book, Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers, is published by Ballantine Books. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Linda, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Give us some sense, first of all, of the changes that kids undergo while in middle school.
Well, there's very little about your kid that doesn't change. The most obvious are the ones that we can see. Maybe they get gangly. Boys on average grow 3 inches a year when they're in middle school. They start to sprout hair in weird places. They either put on or lose weight, as the case may be. Inside their bodies are changing too, but there's a lot more sort of intellectually, physiologically, psychologically that's changing in terms of how they choose their friends, what's important to them, their interests, their intention spans, when they get tired, when they're hungry, how hungry they are, what kind of relationships they want with their parents, all of which are sort of going through an adjustment as the kids enter the early stages of puberty.
Yeah. You say split personalities are common among middle schoolers. What do you mean?
You know, it's really funny. There are parents of kids that I wrote about for my book and that I know through my work who can't possibly imagine their child being anything but completely loud and bossy. And this might be a kid who doesn't say a word at school. Or one of the girls in my book, her teachers during conferences would always compliment her parents on her wonderful sense of humor. And they kept wondering whose child these teachers were talking about because she never got to see it. So it's very easy for a parent to say, oh, my kid wouldn't be like that. They would never bully someone. They would never, you know, talk back in class. When in fact, there's a lot of facets you just don't get to see of your child.
Yeah. Many of us don't remember these years with any kind of fondness. Yet it seems we as adults are uncertain about how to help children make their way through the highs and the lows. What could teachers, parents, other family members do to better understand the middle school student?
Well, the first thing is probably not to not to sort of try to think everything is like the way it was for you. I mean, a kid can only hear so much, you know, when I was in middle school, because they really face a totally a changed world in a lot of ways and different pressures than we faced when they were their age. So the first thing to do is take their problems at face value and not necessarily always try to relate it back to ourselves. These are things that need to start pretty early. If you find your child sort of changing and being difficult at age 11 or 12, and you have not been someone who has communicated with them much and talked to them about their life much, and you try to start now, it's not going to work so well. These are things that you have to start when your child is very young, so that they're comfortable talking to you and telling you things. One of the things is to just sort of be able to listen without jumping down their throats, which is hard to do at times. A lot of times kids tell me that they don't tell their parents stuff that's going on because their parents couldn't handle it, or their parents would try to fix it, or their parents, you know, would have all sorts of advice. Sometimes they just want an ear and someone to say, gosh, that must be awful. Let me know if I can do anything to help, period.
Yeah. How significant are adults in the lives of middle school students?
A lot more than adults give themselves credit for, and that's a really important thing to know. You have just as much influence over your kid at this age in certain ways than you ever have. You know, not necessarily on how they pick their friends or what clothes they choose, but on a lot of the important decisions that they make in their lives. Adults still have a lot of impact. Kids still really want adult attention and praise. I mean, there was not one eighth grader I met, even the toughest-seeming boys, who wasn't thrilled at getting a positive phone call home from a teacher. This stuff still matters to them. They still want to hug you when no one's looking, on their terms, you know. And so it's really important for adults not to think that they don't have impact anymore.
Mm.
You just have to sort of use it in a more subtle way.
Yeah. Maybe stand back, watch, and listen a little.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you don't say, when your child is in elementary school, you can essentially, to some degree, pick your child's friends, right? I mean, you call the mom, and you guys arrange a play date with your friend's kids. When your kids are in middle school, they're going to pick their own friends. That doesn't mean you as a parent can't sort of gently remind your kid how they always come home in a bad mood after they spend time with one friend or another friend and, you know, say, hey, do you want to include Julia tomorrow when you go to such and such, because you know that Julia brings out the best in your kid. I mean, these are things a parent can do.
Yeah. And also the first grader, you can, when they come home from school, you can say, what did you do today? But probably with a middle schooler, you probably want to have another question ready to.
Yeah, it helps to have a slightly more specific question than how is school today or what did you do today, because nothing is going to be the answer no matter what. And you know what? That's okay. You know, your kid doesn't have to narrate everything they did. They don't have to tell you everything. And that's something that's hard to get used to as a parent.
Hmm. Are you a parent?
No.
Hmm. Did that help, do you suppose, talking to these kids?
In some ways it did help. I mean, some people say, well, how can you understand if you haven't been there? I said, well, you know, a lot of times parents understand their kid very well, but that doesn't really give them insight into understanding the other, you know, 12 million middle schoolers. And my benefit was that I could look at them as a whole. I had no sort of preconceived notions or biases about who they were, and I could observe them sort of plainly with a clean slate. And, you know, as well, most parents haven't sort of talked to as many brain scientists and psychologists and read every single piece of research literature there is out there. Because if you're a parent, you maybe don't have time to do that. But if you're spending years studying the age group, you do.
Yeah. Brain development, mind development, that's very interesting. And early in the book, you write, the collective eighth grade of the United States could be labeled doesn't work to potential.
Yep.
Why is it a challenge to motivate these students to do something if they find it at all boring?
Well, one of the things is that they realize that if it's boring, they simply don't have to do it. I mean, they realize that the sky doesn't come crashing down if they don't do their homework. Because you know what? It doesn't. I mean, it doesn't mean there's not going to be some consequence at some point, but they're sort of starting to get this self-will, and in some ways it's good because they're making their own decisions for themselves, but they don't do things, you know, sort of just to please the grown-ups in their lives the way they might have when they were younger. So it's no easy feat to get them interested. You know, that, and things are happening with their minds, their mm-hmm. attention spans, and they're sort of laying out all these cells and connections of various interests and various subjects, and there's a lot going on in there. And so just physiologically, it's hard to sort of capture any little bit of that at a given time.
Yeah. You write from your research, you've learned that the emotional centers are pretty much developed, pretty much set. But there are other skills, there are other brain capacities that are still being formed.
Right. I mean, there's going to be no surprise to anyone who has had any close contact with a middle schooler that organization and cognitive skills are not perfectly developed at this point. You know, they can whine till the cows come home, and they can be really good at that. They're very good at understanding feelings and emotions. They're much better, you know, they're much better than they were when they were younger. They're catching on to that. But when it comes to organization, logic, reasoning, judgment, their brains aren't fully developed yet. And this is a rather new development, rather new understanding that there is this sort of second wave of brain growth. It doesn't just happen in infancy, that it's doing some work when you go through the early stages of puberty as well.
Hmm. Journalist Linda Perlstein is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She was a journalist for The Washington Post. She was an education reporter, and she did a series about the lives of middle school students, and that series was the basis for her book, Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Early in the book, you relate the wisecracking observation of a third grader as his sister prepares for her first day at school. The third grader pipes up, "What if I skip middle school and go straight to high school?" And, you know, it's kind of a good question, I think. Why do we have middle schools?
Well, to be honest with you, and this is an area of great debate right now about what grades middle school should be. And in some ways, I think it's sort of a useless debate, because no matter what grades you make middle school, whether you have K-8 or 6-8 or K-12 or 7-8, kids are still going to have this phase of development. You know, they're still going to have a phase where they are mortified that their armpits might smell. You know, they're still going to have this time when they pull away from their parents, are still going to have a time where their attention in school is not fully focused. That's going to happen no matter what grade configuration you stick kids in. Right now, a lot of people are talking about how K-8 might be better because it sort of keeps the kids grounded and younger in a way. I see also the flip side of that, which is it makes the younger kids grow up a little faster than you'd like them to, because they're around the older kids. So I think this is a debate that has not been resolved, and in fact is much less important than what happens in the individual classrooms, in my opinion.
Yeah. In middle school, is there any kind of a solidarity between these kids, given that they're all sort of in the same boat?
Well, to be they don't sort of discuss, you know, gosh, I'm going through these awkward changes. Are you going through these awkward changes too? I mean, so they're not, you know, the solidarity might be more like, my mom is so annoying. My mom is so annoying too. And, or, you know, pre-algebra is so annoying, you know, but less about that than about the stuff, especially with the boys. I mean, the boys are not sitting there talking to each other about the difficulties of being 11, you know. It's just not, it's not on their agenda. They're not talking about how stressful it is to have a girl not like you. I mean, there's a certain amount of macho involved with being a middle school boy, and unfortunately showing sort of difficulty and vulnerability and emotion is not not a big part of that.
Yeah. But still, everybody's going from, you know, I don't know if you said it, cooties to crushes.
They keep, they share, I mean, they share who they have a crush on and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But to the extent that they are enduring pain, they don't share a lot of that. In that sense, I mean, it's just a lot of kids aren't, I think there's a sort of premium put on feeling like you can handle things and, you know, to the extent that you're sort of, they share what they feel in life is unfair or frustrating, but they don't share their own vulnerabilities as much.
Mm. As the students are about to enter sixth grade, what do they anticipate? What do they look forward to? What are they excited about? What are they anxious about?
They're excited about having lockers, and they're anxious about getting stuffed in them, basically, which, given the size of lockers these days in school, is pretty much impossible because no one has a locker that's wider than 4 inches. But that is very exciting to them. I mean, it sounds, may sound silly to a grown-up, but the idea of having your own little parcel of space that nobody else can access is very alluring to kids, and I can understand why. They're excited about not having to walk down the hallway in lines like they did in elementary school. Some of them get more, maybe have a little more choice of, this doesn't happen everywhere, but maybe have a little more choice of classes. Maybe they get to choose band or an elective or something like that, and that can be fun. But, you know, I think that they know the work is going to be harder. I think that they know that with freedom comes a little bit of, comes, you know, some commensurate responsibility and having to navigate your way around a ever larger building. And that kind of stuff is, you know, just like when the kids go from middle school to high school, it can be kind of scary and exciting at the same time.
Mm.
Usually they're ready, though. I mean, middle schoolers are ready to go to high school, and elementary schoolers are ready to go to middle school.
Yeah.
Even if they're a little scared.
One of the students that you write about in the book is, when we meet her, she's a sixth grader by the name of Mia Riley. And at the outset, she's got her concerns about middle school. She likes school, but she's looking forward to it, but she's a little anxious. And she's also concerned about brokering peace between two of her friends, Lily and Alexandra. Here's the question I'm interested in. What happens to friendships in middle school?
A lot.
Yep.
They change shape completely in some ways. Funny, because just before I got on the phone with you, I was online talking to Mia, and she, you know, she goes into middle school, best friends. She's kind of the popular girl who everyone wants to be friends with, but she's just as anxious as everyone else. You just wouldn't know it because she's the popular one, you know. And what happens is, you know, sometimes in elementary school you're friends with the people who live on your street or who are in ballet class or whatever. In middle school, it's all about creating an identity by choosing who you associate with, you know, which is very different from what you do in elementary school. You're sort of making these attachments and trying to see how other people see you, and you're very, very, I mean, more than anything, you are concerned with where you stand in the social hierarchy, and it can be painful for a lot of kids. I think that's why a lot of adults have harsh memories of middle school. It's about how you fit in or didn't fit in. It just matters more than anything, and these connections with your friends become as important, or actually in many ways more important than the connections that you've had with your family.
Mm.
You turn outward in that sense.
Mm.
And Mia never did manage to broker peace between those two other girls, and she's not particularly friends with either of them now, although she and Lily will both be sitting at the same table at my wedding in 2 weeks, so I'm sure
oh.
they'll. Now that they're going into their junior year, or their sophomore year in high school, they know much better how to treat people, even if they're not good friends with them.
And congratulations and best wishes to you.
Thank you.
What's the response been to the book from all the people in the community of Columbia, Maryland, and in the school building, Wild Lake Middle School?
Well, the kids love it. They're all still my friends, and like I said, a few of them will be at my wedding, and they're, you know, they loved being written about. They weren't embarrassed, strangely enough, by stuff that the rest of us would sort of find very embarrassing to have, you know, the innermost details of our lives written about a book, and the kids didn't have any problem with that, and their parents were great sports about it as well. I think some of the teachers weren't so happy about, some of the teachers at the school loved the book, and the ones that kind of came across as less effective and sort of boring, because this was a book written from these kids' point of view, and in fact, a lot of the teachers were boring, didn't care for the book so much, because nobody wants to be outed as a boring teacher. But in fact, the principal of this school, the one who's sort of the most intimately aware of them as teachers, was very supportive of it and thought it was right on, and so that meant a lot to me.
Yeah. Tell us about the school's principal, Brenda Thomas.
Well, she's clearly a very open woman, or she wouldn't have let me in her school for a year. She is, very committed to her job, and even now, she's gotten moved to another school for this coming up school year, and you know, even now, she sort of feels this sort of lingering sadness that she'll be leaving Wild Lake, but she very much feels strongly about the importance of connecting on a one-on-one level with the kids, that all of those kids should have an adult paying attention to them. And she knew the name of every kid in that school, and that's no small feat because there were, you know, almost 600 kids there. And that was really important to her, and it made a huge difference in these kids' lives. I mean, they call the principal an ogre, but they're really excited, you know, when the ogre knows their name. It's huge. I mean, it really, that adult attention is really huge. It's much huger than you would think.
What are the challenges and rewards of a day in a middle school for the adults in the building?
Challenges are many. I mean, the kids are, it's hard to reason with them. They love to argue, but they don't necessarily lack the cognitive skills to win all their arguments at age 11, you know. There's a lot of whining, and it's just simply noisy. And you have to deal with a lot of drama about who's mad at who and this and that. And it's nothing is ever their fault, you know. I think the most uttered phrase I heard at that school, it was, but I didn't do anything. Now on the flip side, on the plus side, I think that the kids are incredibly engaging and engaged if you are able to sort of make this content in school interesting for them. They're creative and fun, and I certainly enjoy spending time with kids that age and had a blast working on the book. And they just, they're not, you know, by high school, kids get this sort of veneer on them, like, I know everything, there's nothing you can teach me, everything sucks, I'm so cool, you know, this whole thing I find very unappealing. And in fact, my book I'm writing right now takes place in an elementary school. Everyone said, you should go to high school now. I said, no, I'm going back the other way, because I just don't find that appealing at all. And middle school kids don't have that yet. They're still sort of fresh and interested in a way that that their teachers really find fun.
Hmm. However, this age group and even into high school, well known for responses like nothing, I don't know, eye rolling, shrug of shoulders. Was it difficult to get the kids to open up to you?
Not at all. And that's the thing that gets people. I mean, if you think about it, I wasn't their teacher and I wasn't their parent. And they liked having me around. Here's the thing. Kids that age really love attention. They love having adults pay attention to them, but not necessarily their parents or their teachers. Those kids had a lot to say to me. They invited me everywhere. They wanted me everywhere. And, well, I like to think that was just, you know, my charm. The kid had as much to do with, they don't get that kind of attention a lot, and they like it. And that's why I encourage parents to, in turn, encourage friendships with other adults among their kids, because their kids might not tell them everything, but they might tell this aunt or neighbor or coach or friend of the family a lot. And it's more important that they're telling someone most things than they're telling you, their parent, everything.
Yeah. One of the questions that I think middle schoolers are struggling with is, do I have the right stuff? And I mean this both in terms of what's inside the student and also, you know, the material stuff that the package is decorated with. How is it worked out by the kids? What's cool and who's cool?
Oh, well, if I could tell you the exact answer to that, you know, I'd win some sort of prize because it's incredibly complicated. But let's just say it's getting harder for the kids because there's more and more and more. I mean, when I was in middle school, I had, you know, the kids laughed because I got $1 an hour babysitting, you know, and it's like the kids now can't believe it because they get like $9 or something. But it's, the truth is, what do we have to buy? You know, there weren't stores for us. There weren't bands that were made for us. There weren't, you know, entire genres of television geared toward us. And we didn't have our own stores at the mall. We had, like, you know, the children's department of Boston store. And that was pretty much it. And the stakes, you know, the stakes are higher. It's hard to say exactly how the rules are set, but they are, you know, and it's not obvious to everyone, and you're sort of trying to fit in and buy the right stuff and create an identity for yourself at the same time that's somewhat individual, but individual within this very narrow range of what's acceptable. And it's difficult for the kids, and it puts a lot of pressure on them. But as adults, it's hard for us to, it's hard for us as much as we try to get them not to care that much, because we care too as adults. I mean, we care. We want to wear nice clothes and present, read the Da Vinci Code like everyone else is reading the Da Vinci Code. I mean, we have our things as adults too.
Mm. What surprised you the most about what occupies the thoughts of middle schoolers?
I guess sort of on the most basic level, sitting down at the cafeteria table and hearing the sexual talk. You know, these kids aren't going around as much as you know, Oprah might want us to think. They're not going around and having oral sex parties at every corner. But they like to talk about that kind of stuff, and it can be sort of off-putting for an adult. Most of the adults don't get to hear it. I guess I was lucky or unlucky in that way. But, you know, There's a lot kind of swirling around between their ears that they have to deal with, and that was surprising.
Mm. And back to the kids' reaction to the book, not being embarrassed by some of these things.
Well, they're shameless.
They're shameless.
They really are.
Are they getting enough guidance on what's appropriate and what's not?
Well, they get mixed messages, you know. Their mom can tell them one thing, but... And I don't want to be sort of a media prude, but all they have to do is turn on the TV and see a totally different reality of what's acceptable and not. And I think that's probably hard to process.
Mm. How do they ask for guidance when they need it? Do they?
A lot of times they don't. A lot of times they just get it from their friends. I mean, I have kids that watch Eliminate. I don't know if you're familiar with Eliminate, the dating show.
I've heard about it, but I have not seen it.
Basically, it's like one guy goes out with four women one woman goes out with four guys, and as the date goes on, they eliminate one person at a time. And the way the women try not to get eliminated is sort of, well, they try to make out with the guy, or it's sort of like a prove who can be the raunchiest kind of contest. And I actually had a 12-year-old ask me, is that what dates are like?
Wow.
Because that's what they were seeing. And, you know, most kids have the ability to separate maybe what's acceptable on TV
mm-hmm.
and what's not. Actually, I'm not going to say most, but some kids certainly do and some kids don't. And, you know, that's for each individual parent to try to figure out.
Were you asked on other occasions about, you know, is this the way the world works, or what should I do?
Well, I made it pretty clear from early on that I wasn't around to give advice. Now that the book is over, I'm friends with all those kids, and I do give them advice, but they so far haven't asked me too much about certain embarrassing things, but we talk about, you know, boys in general or girls in general, or how to treat someone or how they expect to be treated. They do ask me stuff like that. But most kids don't have someone like me. They have people their age, and then they have their parents.
And their teachers. And
right, but they're not going to go up to ask their... Most kids are not going to go up to their teacher and ask how do you go on a date. Although, actually, some will.
Hmm. What would your advice be to parents on this on this front?
Well, the first thing would be to read a book that's coming out this month, if I could put in a plug for a colleague's book. Sabrina Weil, who used to be editor of 17 Magazine, is coming out with a great book, I think next month, called Teens and Sex. And it's a really good guide for parents talking to their kids about sex. And one of the main points, and it's dating and just relationships, and one of her main points of her book is that it's not a, you know, conversation with a capital C. It's sort of a continuum of open-mindedness and conversation that needs to start when your child, way before you think your child is ready, because your child probably is ready before you are willing to accept that they're ready to talk about it.
Talk with us about another student that you write about in Not Much, Just Chillin', a boy by the name of Jimmy, and his struggles with how his body changes through the year.
He was in sixth grade, and he was starting to go through puberty, and he was growing very tall, very fast. He was, he had this tiny, tiny belly. You wouldn't have been able to notice it with his shirt on, but he could tell with his shirt off that he had this little belly, and he thought maybe he should diet or maybe he should exercise. Of course, he could never stick to any of that, and he didn't really need to, but boys now, just as much as girls, you know, think about their body image in that sense. And he just was changing in a lot of ways in terms of his interests and when he was tired and when he was hungry and he couldn't fall asleep. Your circadian clock changes as you go through the early stages of puberty, and you can't fall asleep as early as you used to. However, you have to get up earlier because middle school usually starts earlier than elementary school. And he was dealing with that, and he was dealing with, you know, growing hair and starting to smell and having to take more showers than he was used to. And some of it he would ask his sister about, and some of it he just sort of fuddled through on his own, and some of it he would talk to his mom about, though not his dad.
Hmm. That issue of what time school should start is also a hot topic. What's your take on it?
Well, my take, personally, as someone who has trouble getting up before 8 o'clock, is that school should start late so that I can get there on time when I'm writing about it. But kids are not, teenagers cannot, are not at their intellectual best at 7 in the morning, and I think it's insane to, because of, you know, either, you know, sort of archaic agrarian reasons or after-school football reasons or bus schedule reasons. I mean, these are the reasons that school, high school starts so early, and middle school as well, and you know, people, convenience of parents or whatever. I think it's crazy, and I think that if you want kids to do their best and be attentive and all of that, you can't expect them to be at school at 7 or 7:30 or 7:50. That's just from my observation and from reading all the research.
Yeah, and also school can, with these extracurricular activities, can stretch also overlap into the evening.
Right. Well, especially with as many things as kids layer on, it does. But, you know, then they get home and you do your homework and you don't get to bed till midnight and then you have to get up at 6 the next day. Kids going through puberty need more sleep, not less. Hmm. Their body needs more sleep, and they're not getting it by any means.
Hmm. The school you wrote about is a school in Columbia, Maryland. What's the community of Columbia like? And one of the things I'm interested in hearing you talk about is class differences and how they affect the middle school experience.
Well, Columbia is a planned community. It was designed where rich and poor and black and white and so on could live side by side in harmony. And in some ways that works. I think that Columbia in general is largely free of some of the racial conflicts of other communities. Kids there, my friends who grew up there, you know, they didn't think twice about dating interracially and were sort of surprised when they went off to college and learned that in some places that's something to even comment about. And that's one of the nice things about Columbia. But, you know, it's a community in some ways like any other. And the more affluent are moving to the further outskirts, leaving the lower income people behind. And the school I wrote about is made up of kids from a low-income black neighborhood and then affluent white neighborhood, just by the way it worked out. And middle school is really when kids start to sort of see differences in that way. And while the kids certainly did not have conflicts because of race and class, the people that they chose to hang out with and chose to interact with pretty much adhered to the lines of race and class, largely because that's who they went to elementary school with in this case.
Hmm. Yesterday on the program, we talked with a fellow who's spent his life in special education, and he's written a book about the emotional lives of children and helping kids with learning disabilities connect socially with their peers and adults. What was your experience with kids in the special education classes, if you had any, at Wild Lake Middle School?
Well, the kids that I wrote about in this book, none of them were in special ed, and a lot of the special ed was done in pull-out classrooms. So many of the kids were not in the regular classroom. But I have in my work for many years as an education writer spent a lot of time with special ed kids. And I do think that in particular, it's very hard in middle school because in middle school, all you want to do is fit in and anything that sort of labels you. There were some teachers that I've seen in various middle schools who have special ed kids in their classroom and do an extremely great job of sort of integrating them so seamlessly that you can't really tell who's getting special attention or not. I mean, they are getting it, but you can't tell. And I think that's really great for kids at that age when it's so, you know, mm-hmm. fitting in is so important. Mm. And special ed is a huge way not to fit in.
Mm. How well did the parents of the sixth graders that you got to know, how well did they come through the year?
Well, I think in the case of the sixth graders I wrote about, you know, I think Jimmy's parents started to have more and more conflicts with him. I think they found it very difficult to get him to do what they wanted. He became more and more impertinent. And I don't think he's a bad kid, but he just became difficult, and they didn't really have a great handle on how to deal with it. I think that Mia's parents had a really good relationship with her, and her mother in particular was really able to help her through the year. And Lily's mother, in the course of the year, adopted a baby, and she had another young son, and she had a daughter, and she had all these foster babies. And I think Lily, to some degree, was left to fend for herself in a lot of ways, and just, you know, she didn't have every sort of little tiny need addressed, but at the same time, she's such an introverted child. She referred to Layla anyway. That's the way she is. She would never tell her mother her problems.
Hmm.
She'd never tell anyone her problems.
Parents, on the other hand, do they sometimes tell their children too much about their problems?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a real big deal with the kids I know. I mean, a lot of them said, oh, I didn't tell you such and such that, I didn't tell my parents such and such that happened at school because they have enough to worry about. And it's, like, sweet that they care, but a 13-year-old shouldn't be so concerned about their parents' problems that they don't think they have room for their own. Parents are really willing to share their burdens with their kids, and it's just simply, you know, it's one thing to be able to show your child that there are problems in life and problems can be solved, but on the other hand, I think kids have enough to worry about without worrying about their parents' love life or their parents' money situation or their parents' job problems.
Mm. So how much do you tell?
Well, you have to use your individual judgment.
Yeah.
But I think that I don't think that any 12-year-old should be the repository for her mother's, you know, boyfriend problems.
Mm. What's the last day of school like for the kids who started in the sixth grade that year that you followed them? How did they feel about middle school at the end of the year?
Well, they felt like they, you know, there's this time in April or March or April when sixth graders turn into middle schoolers, you know. They're sort of sweet for the beginning of the year, and then they turn into middle schoolers, you know. And all the behavior and friendship ramifications that come with it. So by the time By the time they're at the end of sixth grade, they think they have a pretty good grip on it, and they're ready for seventh grade. They're ready not to be the babies of the school anymore.
Mm. How do
eighth graders are just sort of, the girls are sort of crying in this maudlin, you know, 14-year-old way.
Yeah.
Even though they couldn't wait to get out of middle school, and they're going to see each other, you know, they're going to, like, IM each other as soon as they get home, but they're still crying at school.
That's instant message.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big thing, too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
All the different... Well, you and I probably spent a lot of time on the telephone.
Actually, I spend a lot of time on instant message because...
Oh, okay.
I write about kids for a living, but yeah, it's this is how they communicate.
Yeah. And when they leave, there's somebody at the end of the book, and they're I don't know if they're saying this to one another. You can tell me. They're saying this to one another, or they're writing it down in the yearbook or whatever, but, you know, BBFE.
Yeah, that was in the yearbook.
Yeah, best friends forever,
except really it's probably, you know, till the middle of June or something.
Until we stop IMing.
But I did that, too. I mean,
yeah.
That hasn't
sure.
changed. There's some things about middle school that are completely enduring, yeah. And don't change. And if I looked at, you know, sort of the trail of my best friends forever, it would be a long list, some of whom I probably wouldn't even remember. Probably couldn't tell you what they look like.
Mm. Well, middle school, at least, it doesn't last forever, right?
Yeah, that's what the principal tells the parents when they come in at the beginning of sixth grade. She says to them, middle school ends. That's one thing you have to remember.
Linda, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Linda Perlstein has been my guest here on the Afternoon Magazine this afternoon. She's a journalist. She is the author of Not Much, Just Chillin', The Hidden Lives of Middle Schoolers. The book is published by Ballantine Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste. And indeed, those settlement prices are in. Before we get to them, let's bring up the final yield results from Farm Newsletter Pro Farmer Crop Tour. The John Deere Pro Farmer Tour pegged this year's U.S. corn production at 10.162 billion bushels, soybean production 2.783 billion bushels. After this week's crop tour of the Midwest Corn Belt, the average corn yield, according to Pro Farmer, 136.6 bushels to the acre. The average soybean yield, 38.5 bushels to the acre. That compares with USDA's August report of 139.2 bushels per acre for corn, and for soybeans, 38.7. We'll discuss the implications of the Pro Farmer John Deere numbers in just a few minutes with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana, as well as other factors weighing in on the market this week. Let's go ahead and get you caught up with the current tick. September wheat on the settles, a high of 316 and a half, a low of 311. The settlement 313 and make it 312 and a quarter, down 3 and a half. December, a high of 331 and a half, a low of 326 and a half, settling 327 and a half, down 3 and a half. March, a high of 343 and a half, a low of 338 and three quarters, settling 339 and three quarters, down 4 and a half. May, a high of 349, a low of 345, settling 345 and a half, down 5. July, a high of 352 and a half, a low of 349, settling 349 and three quarters, down 2 and three quarters. September corn, a high of 206 and a half, a low of 203, settling 203 and three quarters, down 2 and a half. December, a high of 220, a low of 217, settling 217 and three quarters, down 2. March, a high of 229 and three quarters, a low of 227, settling 227 and three quarters, down 1 and three quarters. May, a high of 235 and a half, a low of 233, settling 234, down 1 and a quarter. July, a high of 240 and three quarters, a low of 238, settling 239 and a quarter, down 1 and a quarter. September corn, a high of 244 and a half, a low of 243 and a quarter, settling 243 and three quarters, down 3 quarters. September oats, a high of 150 and a quarter, a low of 147 and three quarters, settling 148, down 2. December, a high of 159 and a quarter, a low of 156, settling on the low, down 3 and a quarter. The soybean complex was the bright spot on the Chicago Board of Trade if you were looking for upside potential today, but it did not rally above last week's lows and putting in some new lows on the board, particularly in that lead option month, September, 592 and a half, the high, 587, the low, settling 591, up 4 on the day, but down on the week. November, a high of 603 and a half, a low of 597 and a half, settling 602, up 4 and a quarter on the day, but on the week, the NOVS contract down 5 and a half. January, a high price of 610 and a half, a low of 604 and a half, settling 609 and a quarter, up 5. March, a high of 617, a low of 611, settling 615 and three quarters, up 5. May, a high of 618 and a half, a low of 613, settling 618, up 4 and three quarters. The July contract, a high of 622 and a half, a low of 615, settling 622 and a quarter, up 5 and a half. September soybean meal, a high of 184.70, a low of 182.90, settling 183.70, unchanged on the day. October, a high of 185.50, a low of 183.80, settling 184.80, up 50 cents. September soybean oil, a high of 22.20, a low of 21.95, settling 22.08, up 2. And the October soybean oil contract, a high of 22.32, a low of 22.06, settling 22.20, up 5 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and Celeste, as our analysts were predicting earlier in the week, it's giddy-up time.
Yeah, prices higher today, significantly higher. Let's take a look at what happened today on the Merc. September feeder cattle, the high 111.50, the low 110.15, the settlement 111.45, that up 150. October, 110.02.5, the high, the low 108.95, the low 109.87.5, that up 127.5. November, 109.30, the high 107.90, the low, the settlement 109.25, up 152.5. August live cattle, 82.70, the high 81.80, the low 82.37.5, the settlement, that up 87.5. October, 83.20, the high 82.17.5, the low, the settlement 83.05, up 92.5. October lean hog, 64.37.5, the high, 63.30, the low, 64.22.5, the settlement, that up 90. December, 61.80, the high, 60.45, the low, 61.65, the settlement, that up 105. February lean hog, 62.60, the high, 61.32.5, the low, 62.55, the settlement, that up 85. April lean hog, 61 even, the high, the low 60.30, finishing at 60.97, that up 20. August belly, 73.92.5, the high, the low 73.42.5, finishing at 73.92.5, up $2. Let's take a look now at the Dow. It is currently down 27 points at 10,424. The NASDAQ down 9 points at 2126. The S&P 500 4 lower at 1208.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Say hello to the tough cookies.
And say hello to one of America's most violent sports.
Yes, here she comes into the pack. I can Razor block out. Razor blocks out Kitty Stratus for Crybaby. Crybaby flies past the tough cookies.
Bruised ribs, bloody shoulders, and the return of roller derby. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Have you entered the WILL sweepstakes yet? There's still time to win one of a dozen fabulous prizes, but you can't win if you don't enter. Don't miss your chance to bring home the $2,000 grand prize shopping spree and design services from Carter's Furniture, a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an exquisite area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, or an AgriFab lawn vac. Entries must be postmarked by September 6th.